and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. We unpack the Supreme Court's decision activists say has gutted the Voting Rights Act and what it could mean for future elections.
I'm headed back to the Philippines to deeply connect with my family.
And a documentary airing on WTTW explores Filipino culture and cuisine with Chicago restaurateur Billy Dick. First off tonight, workers at Brookfield Zoo hit the picket line this morning, walking out after contract negotiations with management broke down last week. The strike includes grounds, custodial, and facilities employees, but animal care professionals are currently on the job, according to a statement from the zoo. Teamsters Local 727, which represents the more than 200 workers, rejected a deal that they say offered raises below 4% and also eliminated an existing 100% employer-paid health care benefit. But management disputed that claim. The zoo remains open for guests. Officials say the care and well-being of animals remains their highest priority, and they remain focused on reaching a contract that, quote, supports employees while protecting the zoo's long-term sustainability. Labor groups and some elected officials are pushing for an increase in the federal minimum wage. The rate has sat stagnant at $7.25 an hour since 2009. Advocates are pushing to bump it up to $25 an hour. At an event today, the National Education Association pointed out how that impacts many school workers.
From clerical workers, bus drivers, to food service workers, to custodial and maintenance workers and paraeducators, but often earn wages that barely scrape the floor. These ESPs are the first faces students see in the morning and the last ones that they see before they go home. Yet many of them cannot afford to support their own families. One-third of ESPs earn $25,000 a year or less. 10% of them rely on food assistance.
Democratic Congressmembers Delia Ramirez and Chuy Garcia of Illinois introduced the Living Wage for All Act last week, which calls for that increase. Many states, including Illinois, currently have a minimum wage above the federal level. Critics of increasing the minimum wage say it could hurt business and result in higher prices for consumers. If you're a business owner, a new state facility may come in handy. Officials say the new Business Services Center located downtown will streamline services, improve accessibility, and save taxpayer dollars. Some of the services being provided at the downtown facility include filing articles of incorporation for corporations and LLCs, filing trademarks, getting assistance with certificates of good standing and reinstatements, and processing documents for international use. And the Fastlane DMV kiosk allows people to renew their driver's licenses and state IDs and purchase vehicle registration stickers with on-site printing of temporary documents. Secretary of State Alexi Giannoulias says the move eliminates nearly $650,000 in ongoing lease costs by consolidating operations into a state-owned building. Up next, the Supreme Court's decision to weaken the Voting Rights Act explained right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
I dissent then from this latest chapter in the majority's now completed demolition of the Voting Rights Act. That's Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan in her dissent of a 6-3 ruling last week in Louisiana versus Calais. The ruling determined that Louisiana's congressional maps, which include two majority-minority districts designed to give minority voters a chance to elect their preferred representatives, are unconstitutional. The decision is expected to have long-lasting ramifications that could be felt as soon as the 2026 midterms, with states racing to redraw their maps before November. Joining us to break down the ruling are Ryan Tolley, executive director of Change Illinois, a nonprofit that advocates for fair legislative maps in Illinois; Michael Kang, a law professor at Northwestern University; and Karen Freeman Wilson, President and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. Welcome back. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Michael Kang, I want to start with you, please. What was it that the judges were being asked to consider in this case? Break it down for us, please.
Yeah, technically speaking here, Louisiana was ordered by a lower court to draw a second majority minority district under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which basically guarantees minority representation under certain conditions that it seems that minorities are being denied their kind of fair share of representation. That was appealed up to the Supreme Court, and what the state ended up arguing was that the intentional drawing of the second district that it was being asked to do under the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional, that it was unconstitutionally considering race by the state. That defied kind of Voting Rights Act practice for 50 years, but we have a different court that's ready to consider this sort of change, and they declared that consideration of race in the intentional drawing of this majority-minority district unconstitutional. This has huge ramifications for the way that politics are conducted and the way that we think about voting rights.
Karen Freeman Wilson, what was your reaction to the court's ruling?
Well, the ruling was really a gut punch, Brandis, and further evidence that over the last 13 years, this Supreme Court has been intent on not only gutting the Voting Rights Act, but eliminating the Voting Rights Act. And this, in many respects, was the final nail in the coffin.
Ryan Totley, the Republican governors of both Alabama and Tennessee, they have called for special legislative sessions to potentially adjust their congressional maps ahead of the midterms. We just heard Michael Kang say it, that there could be long-lasting ramifications. What could the effects of this ruling be on the 2026 elections?
Yeah, there's a few states, as you said, who are already considering redrawing the maps because these legal tools that voters had to ensure their representation are gone. And what we're likely to see is just a lot more partisan gerrymandering because voters don't have those tools to fight back. 2026, some states are going to be constrained because they already have primary elections that have passed or they're too far into petition process. But especially for 2028 and beyond, it's just going to be wide open for states to gerrymander like we haven't seen previously.
Michael
Kang.
We've
also seen, Albrecht.
Go ahead, Karen.
No, I was just going to say, in Louisiana, they literally canceled or postponed an election so that they could change the map. It's sort of like changing the rules in the middle of a game, but this isn't a game. That's the important part.
So it's already happening, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Michael Kang, the Roberts Court has weakened the Voting Rights Act twice before, once in 2013, again in 2021. Remind us of those rulings, please.
Yeah, this is really the third act in a larger kind of deconstruction of voting rights by this court. The 2013 decision was Shelby County, and that got rid of a really important part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, that basically forced covered jurisdictions to prove before it could implement any sort of change to their election rules that they were not discriminating, either in terms of effect or intent. That was wiped away, and what that meant was a lot more pressure fell on the remaining provision in the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. Section 2 is a little different. It's not a preclearance provision. It requires plaintiffs to come forward and sue after an election change has been made. It had generally been applied to redistricting. So in a decision a few years ago, Brinovich, basically, the court had to review how to apply Section 2 to election rules changes that previously had fallen under Section 5 before Shelby County. A lot of conservatives had argued that we don't need Section 5 because we have Section 2. In Brinovich, that Section 2 application to these election rule changes was made much more difficult, and really there hasn't been a successful Section 2 suit since. So those were two elements that came in, and this is the third part, which basically makes it almost impossible to bring a successful Section 2 suit in redistricting, which is where Section 2 had had a lot of force in ensuring some minority representation, particularly in the South, but other than the South as well. And this now requires proof of intentional discrimination, which is very hard to prove in litigation. And you have to show not only that minority voters are being hurt, not just in terms of the effect, but because of race as opposed to party. To the degree that you have a Republican government that is intent on advancing Republicans and hurting Democrats, even if they target Black voters, say, who vote Democratic, that seems, according to the court, okay, because that's kind of partisan discrimination. And the court, in a, yet another decision, had decided the Constitution has no restrictions on partisan gerrymandering. So when you combine all of those things, you're likely to see partisan gerrymandering just go crazy.
So I want to get into one of the things that you mentioned there, Michael, with Karen. Karen, the court ruled, as we just heard, that the state legislatures are allowed to redraw maps in pursuit of political ends, right? So allowing Republicans to target minority populations as Democrats rather than targeting them as Black voters, Hispanics, so on. What's your reaction to them leaving that open?
Well, I think it just creates an opportunity for people to change maps, to disenfranchise voters, to essentially use the partisan political issue as a pretext for really discriminating racially. And while you can't prove intent, we always see the impact. And so the impact will be there without any protection against it, because people will be able to use the pretext, oh, we're not just focused on race, we're really focused on political party, and we just want this to be a Republican or supermajority Republican state. And so next door to us in Indiana, my home state, there is a peril of seeing two districts that are represented by Democrats that have a significant Black population, essentially having those people that vote Democrat disenfranchised in the interest of advancing a Republican agenda.
So, Ryan, some advocates are urging Democrat-led states then to respond in kind by redrawing districts to favor Democrats. We've already seen California and Virginia revisit their redistricting moves after Texas. And you've already mentioned concern about this sort of setting off a redistricting arms race, sort of. What could the impact be for then for voters? Will we see what Karen Freeman Wilson just referenced, fewer majority-minority districts?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a reality we could be facing. I think for a lot of states, though, we have to remember who is losing out here, and it's voters. And for states like Illinois, there are tools available to us to protect Illinois voters. There's legislation in the State House to create an Illinois Voting Rights Act that would ensure a lot of these protections for vote dilution, voter suppression. And I don't want us to lose sight either that this is also going to affect state maps, it's going to affect local maps. And so it's really important for a state like Illinois to lead the way on protecting voting rights by ensuring our state passes legislation that gives those protections to voters, and we don't see similar things happening in Illinois with vote dilution and voter suppression.
And since you mentioned it, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, he has entertained redistricting in the past. There have been talks about amending the state constitution to bolster the protections of the VRA. You mentioned that. Should Illinois, you mentioned the Illinois Voting Rights Act. Should Illinois be passing this? How should other states be responding?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that isn't within the power of the Illinois state legislature to pass, and we should do that immediately. We should be an example for other states on how we can ensure voters are protected with the loss of these federal safeguards. It's not going to be the end-all be-all to fix the problem nationally, but we got to remember we have to start somewhere, and a state like Illinois can lead the way here.
Karen Freeman Wilson, the Roberts Court has long held that policies should not consider race, whether it is to help or hurt minority populations, that sort of race-blind argument. What do you make of that, that policies just should stop discriminating on the basis of race, period?
I think it's fictional. When you look at the fact that we have not existed in a colorblind society for 400 years, to say that today we're going to start being colorblind is a misplaced effort to negate history. And you just cannot do that. You can do it, obviously the court has, but it's mythical.
Michael Kang, we've got about 30 seconds left. You know, the Roberts Court has, you know, we mentioned, made some decisions before. How does this case fit into the broader pattern of the court's approach to race-conscious laws?
I think it's of a piece of with all the other decisions. It's an attempt to get law out of regulating race discrimination in all different kinds of ways. And so I think to the degree that you're worried about discrimination in voting and in politics, you're worried about racial representation getting wiped out, this case sort of completes a kind of retreat by the court and of law from that space.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. More to come on this, I'm not sure, honestly. Michael Kang, Karen Freeman Wilson, Ryan Tolley, thanks to the three of you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Brandis.
Thank you.
Up next, serving up Filipino cuisine and culture with Chicago restaurateur Billy Deck.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
A documentary airing on WTTW is serving up Filipino cuisine as the main course.
So I'm headed back to the Philippines to deeply connect with my family, to really reconnect with the culture.
This is unbelievable.
Our heritage. And the food that I grew up loving.
Food Roots follows restaurateur Billy Deck as he returns to the Philippines to reunite with family and learn some new dishes along the way. And joining us now is Billy Deck, restaurateur, actor, former advisor to President Obama's Commission on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, just to name a few of the literal hats that you wear. Welcome back. Good to see you.
It's so good to be back.
So what made you want to document this journey and in this way with a documentary film?
Well, originally I was just documenting it so that when I was going back to the islands of the Philippines to learn the recipes of my ancestors, finding family in all these remote villages and mountains and beachside towns, that I wasn't consumed with the process of writing things down. I just wanted to be present. Because the whole reason I was sort of left out, I didn't learn the recipes that are never written down, is because I wasn't present. I was in America, you know, trying to hustle and, you know, be everything that America tells you you need to be successful. But going back to the Philippines, you know, documenting it and just going from food to family to life, all these things started to unwind. And when we got home, we noticed that the footage was unlike anything we ever expected. And an Oscar-winning producer friend and an Emmy-winning Filipina director who knew the culture as well saw the footage, and Apple Diaz from Black Eyed Peas started putting music to it, and they made this magic come about.
Filipino food, it's having a moment, right? Yeah. More restaurants are opening. I'm thinking about Boonies, shout out. Kasama yeah. has a James Beard Award, 2 Michelin stars. What do you think is driving all of this interest?
Well, I think the genre of food is extremely exciting. It's always evolving. It's totally innovative. Part of its unique characteristics is that it's been, you know, had influences from all around the world. And it's so bright and beautiful and delicious and unique. But at the same time, it's just been this genre of food that hasn't really been explored. And I think with the explosion of Chef TV and food adventurers and all these content creators that have made their way around the world to these beautiful 7,641 islands of the Philippines, they started to really create intrigue and excitement, demand, and attraction to this type of food in this really beautiful part of the world.
In the documentary, you said that as a kid, you experienced bullying mm. from other kids, mm-hmm. Making fun of the Filipino food that you would bring to school for lunch. You were jealous as a kid of, you know, what other kids ate. What made you, you know, once you grew up, fall back in love with Filipino food?
Yeah, I mean, no one wanted to trade with me at the lunch. At lunch, you know, they had like Pop Tarts and like Wonder Bread sandwiches, smushed, you know, like old school. And I had like these, you know, fish and vinegar and things that people freak out about now and love. You know, you grow up loving what your grandma, my Lola, raised me on in the house. And once you hit middle school and high school, you begin to push away a bit because people make you feel a little uncomfortable. I think once I left for college and went on to be an adult, and especially law school, and went away to and lost my Lola, I really had a void. Something was wrong and missing. And that's when we started playing around with Sunda, which is 18 years old now. We had to be very careful with the introduction of Filipino food back in the day because nobody really was interested in it. So it was Southeast Asian elevated, and it played with all these different countries around the region, including Filipino food.
So yeah, let's talk about Filipino food just a little bit and what some of the, you know, the staples and flavors are that, yeah, you know, Filipinos who are familiar with that food,
yeah,
the stuff they call home.
I like to say it's very much a foundation of Southeast Asian flavors and feels that you're used to, but then you get to integrate some things, especially from Spain and China are the big ones for me. But there's, you know, Japan, Malaysia, India, US, you name it, there's so many different influences. I think that there's a really wonderful mix and of umami, this burst of real savory flavor that people aren't used to, combined with these fresh, bright citrus and fruits and vegetables that come from the Philippines. But yeah, it's just a mix like another. And again, it evolves, and that is what's great about it. So it always is something new.
There's a moment in the film where you make lumpia with your Lola or grand aunt, because it sounds like that is applied to both grandmothers and grand aunts.
Yeah.
Grand aunts, great aunts. What did that mean to you to be able to do that with her?
It was, first of all, like for being transported almost spiritually to be with my Lola, who I'd missed so much since she passed away. This was her sister and the last remaining elder of that generation. I really felt like an incredible connectivity with her. I was really like flashbacking on cooking or seeing my Lola cook, but also learning that there was a way in which she did it different from everyone that really unveiled a family story and a story about Filipinos and perseverance and all these sort of things. She had grown up in another home, and I would have never known that unless someone told me that. But that's what these journeys do back in time when you really deep dive on what your ancestors did to come together, love, and take care of each other. It unearths shocking stories.
You also get, you know, very personal in the film. You're sharing, you know, the tragedy of the deaths of your father, your brother, both of whom struggled with mental illness, and of course the deaths of your other Lolas. Was making this film sort of therapeutic for you as well?
Totally. I think coming up in Chicago, I had a lot of things that I was hiding because it seemed as if I would not be able to excel in this world, right or wrong, if I didn't act like I had it together, and that I was projecting sort of a person that had control of their situation. And I really, you know, went out there with the same way in which I do cooking shows and segments at local and national shows, and it was me, the character that I'd built with the strong walls. But when I was engaging with these elders through story, something happened, something broke down. And I think that's when this, you know, these Oscar, Emmy, Grammy-winning producers were like, what's that? We need to explore that. And it was essentially me having to tell the truth about my real challenges. And it was super therapeutic. I feel so blessed to have this out there. I'm so surprised. We did film fest routes across the country, and these theaters were filled with people that were completely diverse, nothing like me. And they all were like reacting emotionally, like laughing, crying, starving, all the things. And it's because it's a human story that I think a lot of people go through, you know, whether it's mental illness, whether it's, you know, being poor or being challenged in certain ways, all themes that kind of went through in and out of the story. It just shows that we can persevere, we can keep going, you know, and it really resonated with a lot of people, so it made me feel good, and the release that you're talking about was there.
Yeah, there are a lot of definitely beautiful moments in the film. There's another one later on that I won't tell people about. They have to go and watch it.
it does involve blood.
It does involve a little bit of blood, but the food looks amazing as well. Definitely made me hungry. Billy Deck, congrats on the film. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This is great.
You bet. And Food Roots airs here on WTTW at 9 p.m. on Monday, May 11th. And we're back right after this. And that's our show for this Monday night. It's starting to warm up outside, and with the nice weather comes hundreds of festivals. Check out our website for details on events happening across Chicago and the suburbs, from parades and concerts to food fests and art shows. It's all at WTTW.com/festivals. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.